fellow investors, welcome back to the Newcomer Investor channel. Whether you're new or experienced, everyone's welcome. On this channel, we talk about great businesses and make investing accessible and fun for everyone. I'm your host, Anthony. Welcome back to the show. Now, as always, my friend, I must remind you that nothing I say is financial advice. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm just telling you what I do. But I've made a lot of mistakes on this journey of learning to be a better investor, and as a result, I'd highly recommend that you do your own research. Now, we've got a series of topics for today, but I'd like to start off with some business news. If you live in Canada, you've probably heard about this, but Restaurant Brands International, the parent company of Tim Hortons, Popeyes, Burger King, and Firehouse Subs, shook up the QSR space last week because they announced a new product for Tim Hortons, and that product is pizza. Now, you know, when you analyze a business or an initiative launched by a business, you have to do so with as little bias as possible. Now, on one hand, I am a huge fan of RBI in general, right? I've spoken about it a lot. I own it in my portfolio. I'm very happy with it. But on the other hand, I absolutely detest cheese, and all of these pizza offerings have cheese, so I hate that too. So I feel like those two things kind of cancel each other out, and I feel like I can be pretty objective and neutral about this. Now, all jokes aside, let's talk about the why of this initiative. Why on earth are they thinking of selling pizza? And to understand this, I think it's helpful to actually go into the past and see what happened before. Now, let's take a trip back in time, 2019, 2020. What was the discussion? Tim Hortons is leaving people behind. No one likes it anymore. The brand value is plummeting. Everything's just terrible, right? And what happened? Executive leadership came up with a plan. They called it the Back to Basics plan. The idea was, we are doing way too many limited time offers. We're all over the place. We have no clue what's going on. Let's focus on getting the core stuff right. What are we known for? We're known for coffee, you know, decent coffee and good donuts. So let's kind of do that. So they went on a huge plan to improve product quality in every store, improve the digital guest experience, including that Tim's Rewards program, bring them actual proper machines, because, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but a lot of the franchise stores, they all had different coffee machines, right? They didn't all have the exact same standardized process. Now they do. And lo and behold, of course, they put that plan together, they executed it, and now they are doing extremely well. Now, you know, whenever I post about Tim Hortons, I have someone on Twitter who's like, oh, well, you know, when I went to my local one, the coffee wasn't hot enough or the service wasn't that great or things like that. And yes, I mean, that happens, of course, right? But I am trying not to be, you know, emotional and take things at the person level. I'm looking at a macro level when it comes to the company. And the truth is, if you crunch the numbers, they are doing extremely well. Their latest results, it's been, I don't know what, like 8 or 10 quarters of increasing same-store sales. This is incredible, right? So they are by far the dominant domestic player over here in Canada. They sell the majority of all the coffee cups sold in the country and the most donuts, etc. They're doing very well. Now, when you are as big and dominant as a brand like Tim Hortons, you are faced with the reality of something we call the law of diminishing returns. The truth is that if you're a lousy operator and everything you do is terrible and you have no market share, then, you know, if you spend $50 million, you can actually probably turn things around and do very well. But if you're number one and you're freaking giant and you're everywhere, then if you put $50 million, you're probably not going to get much improvement. And this is the issue that Tim's is facing. Now, one of their things that they were able to do, which they are doing, is go international, right? If you dominate Canada, go to China, go to India, go to all these other places with much bigger populations and just keep growing. That's great. But the thing is, Tim's obviously has an executive team here in Canada, and they want to still grow in Canada. This is a very intense team that is hell-bent on winning no matter what. And so, when you dominate the breakfast category, coffee and donuts, it's time to assess trying to break into the next frontier, which is the evening category. And that is exactly what the move is with this pizza adventure that they're launching. Now, this strategic rationale was confirmed by their chief marketing officer, Hope Bagozzi, who's a very critically acclaimed marketing person, who I believe came from McDonald's actually before. They got some heavy hitters. So she confirmed this is their attempt to stretch the brand. Now that they really dominate and they've made all the progress they wanted on the Back to Basics plan, it was time for them to start looking at areas where they were not as strong historically, which, like I said, is the evening afternoon category. It's worth mentioning also, for those who don't know, that the afternoon and beyond segment segment is the fastest growing one in the fast food industry in Canada. It's an $8.5 billion market. It's growing at about 5% per year. And their market share, the Tim Hortons one, is only 4%. So there's so much room to grow there. If they just make even just a dent against, you know, the incumbents, the McDonald's and so on, then that's going to bring in a lot of extra money. So I see this venture really as one that has a lot of upside and not a lot of downside. If it doesn't work, they'll just pull this, you know, off of the shelves and just continue doing what they're doing and winning anyway, right? It's also interesting to look at the pricing strategy. Again, if you follow me on Twitter, you see I talk a lot about this, right, of some brands have more of a premiumization strategy and some try to be cheap. Starbucks, for example, is premium. Tim Hortons stays within the more affordable category, so those pizzas start at $6.99, which is really not that much. It's actually quite affordable. So that's the cheapest one, and then the three other more expensive ones, $7.99, which is also quite cheap. Now, in their analysis, like within the RBI in-house team, I don't know at all, right, what they've decided or what their integrated communication strategy is going to look like. But, you know, if I had to guess, I would imagine their kind of target, I'd split it probably into two groups. One is really like young college kind of students. You know, you're studying and you're doing a group project and you're going to just get a cheap snack because you have no money and buy a bunch of those pizzas kind of all together for you and your friends. That would be maybe one market. And then the other would be, you know, children. Like, let's say you're a parent, you're on your way home from work, you didn't have time to cook, and there's a Tim's, and, you know, if you're your kid, you don't really know what good food is, or some kids do maybe, but most kids probably don't. And so, you know, if you just want to have like a cheesy bread for your kid because you didn't have time to cook something, that could be a snack that you bring back home, for example. These are kind of the types of audiences that I can picture probably that would want food like that. But either way, like I said, right, lots of upside, very little downside. So as a shareholder, I am very excited, even if I hate cheese. I think it is a good decision. And now the time is right, just because, like I said, they've executed the Back to Basics plan. It's worked. So why not look for these other ways to continue growing and continue dominating? So I'm fully behind the team. I think it's an excellent idea. And honestly, time will tell. A lot of people already saying, oh, it's going to fail because I think McDonald's tried 10 years ago and it failed. It very much could fail. It's possible. But I think it also could succeed. And so we shall see. Okay, now moving on to the topic that you actually probably clicked this episode to listen to. Haha, I feel like I trolled everyone with this whole 7-minute segment about pizzas that no one cares about. But no, all jokes aside, contrarian stocks to possibly buy. Obviously, this is not investing advice. I'm just throwing these ideas at you and at myself, honestly. But I think, you know, these are businesses worth probably starting to at least consider a look at for now. But number one is Quebecor, ladies and gentlemen, ticker symbol QBR.B. Now, this selection, obviously, we're not reinventing the wheel. If you follow me for a while, you've already heard about this stock. I've spoken about it several times. Now, why am I bringing it up again? Well, obviously, price matters. It's now trading under $30. In fact, as of today, we're at $28.58. Now, if this is new to you, I must tell you, they ended the year 2023 with $2.82 in earnings per share. So they're trading pretty much at 10 times earnings, or to be precise, 10 times trailing earnings. And I do expect them to do even better in 2024, which I think is extremely cheap for what is now really the fourth national telecom provider, right? They are established. Obviously, they are still not as widely recognized as, you know, Bell, Rogers, and Telus, but they have more than proven their worth, I think, and it's crazy to me that they would trade at such a cheap valuation. Now, as we all know, right, Quebecor used to be really just concentrated in the province of Quebec, but now with the acquisition of Freedom Mobile, they are a national player. With the acquisition, the number of Canadians reached by their mobile networks increased from 77.5 million, which is about 20% of Canada's population, to more than 26 million, which is 70% of Canada's population. So that significantly increased their addressable market. If you are a dividend-oriented investor, as I know many of us on this channel are, right, we enjoy dividends, they increased it 8.3% this year. And the really cool part is they can actually afford it. With a dividend now sitting at 32.5 cents and earnings per share last quarter at around, I think, 63 cents per share. Clearly, they, you know, the payout ratio is really nice. And actually, their policy is to try to keep that dividend in line with 40% of their operating cash flow. So it's truly fantastic having a telecom that actually doesn't pay more than they can afford. That is a nice contrast to another one like Bell, right? Which currently is actually paying out more cash flow than they're bringing in, which is a bit of a danger sign, right? There are no such of these red flags with Québecor right now. It's interesting how I feel a lot of investors, because Québecor is still, you know, not as big or as established as some of the giants, it trades at this kind of a discount. And yet, they are on such a solid financial footing compared, I believe, to the others, right? It's really interesting how that works. I think it's some of it has to do with the whole out of sight, out of mind kind of thing, right? Where because it was mostly in Quebec, a lot of people in, you know, Anglophone Canada didn't really think about it. But I'm hoping now with this freedom growth, things are going to start changing. But I would say it's probably good to start loading up on that stock before that change in investor sentiment happens, right? Now, one of the bearish arguments that one could bring up about Québecor is its media segment, which has suffered and struggled so much. And again, this is a whole industry-wide thing. We've seen the same with Bell Media, right? But yes, Québecor's media arm called TVA Group, it's been a disaster. But there are reasons to believe that the worst may be over. And the main reason being a giant restructuring program, right? So they cut, and it's very sad news, right? But they cut a very large portion of the employee base. And they are significantly scaling down their operations to bring costs in line with their declining revenues. That is going to make a big difference, actually, in stemming some of those losses. And the other reason that I would not worry so much about it is that with this acquisition of Freedom Mobile, the telecom segment of the whole Québecor business is now becoming so large that the media arm, not to say it's irrelevant because it isn't, but it's really not making a very big difference, right? So as of 2023, if you look at the full years, this is very rough numbers, but the telecom segment was around 85% of the business. The media was around 11-12%, and then the sports and entertainment was 3%. So as Québecor's telco segment grows more and more, faster and faster across the whole country, you can expect that to take on a much bigger portion of the entire business. And as a result, the media segment, any negative thing that could occur from it would have a smaller and smaller impact on the overall stock. So overall, there's a lot I could say about Québecor, but like I said, you've heard me talk about this stock a lot over the last months. I think this is a very strong business. It's a growth engine, right? It's going to actually grow, I think, faster than the other telecom businesses over the next 5 years or so. And it's cheap. So this is definitely my contrarian selection number one. And I added a little bit throughout the month of April, by the way. I bought actually a bit. So I put my money where my mouth is. I actually think this one's going to do well. Number two contrarian play is RioCan. Ticker symbol REI.UN. This is a REIT. Now, before going any further, I do have to caution everyone that REITs are extremely unpopular right now. And for good reason. I mean, real estate, when interest rates are high, that is not necessarily the place you want to go to, right? But the reason I would describe this as contrarian is, to me, this is a business that has what it takes to withstand the current environment and come out of it stronger in the future. And also, I mean, again, putting my money where my mouth is, I own this REIT. I've owned it for 4 years now, and I'm very happy to own and not planning to sell anytime soon. Now, what makes RioCan interesting? RioCan is a primarily retail REIT, though they're slowly expanding into other types of real estate. What makes their strategy quite different from, I think, a lot of other REITs is how they've actually decided to really focus on the six core key Canadian markets, being Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, the Greater Toronto Area, Ottawa, and Montreal. Not only are they focused on these six markets, if you look deeper into the numbers, you look at the percentage of total fair value of their income-producing properties, it's actually 57.2% in the Greater Toronto Area. So really, if you're buying RioCan, you're actually making a play on Toronto retail real estate. Now, if I want to dedicate a few seconds to number crunching, I will say that, you know, they are doing delivering healthy results in that end. They've got a 97.4% committed occupancy, which is pretty good. Funds from operations growing 5.2% compound annual growth rate since 2021. That's good. So very decent here. 4.8% commercial net operating income growth. That's also good. It's their third consecutive year of having more than 3%. So it's not extreme growth, but it's very reasonable growth for the area that they operate in. Of course, the stuff that I like and I'm interested in, the macro environment. There are many, many positive macro aspects that play in Ryokan's favor. The first one being obviously our growing population. Canada is taking in so many people, and that is amazing for a business like this, specifically because Ryokan is centered in the major cities, which is where most people go, right? If you're a new immigrant, you do not go to a village of 500 people. You tend to go to a very large city where your community is already established. So, of course, many people come to Toronto. It's the number one destination, and that plays well for Ryokan. The other thing, too, is the shortage of retail supply. My friends, I wish I had that number in front of me, but I remember once reading this study about how much more retail real estate per capita there is in the US compared to Canada. The truth is, we don't have that much retail over here, right? And this is why Ryokan is able to maintain very high occupancy rates through, honestly, you know, all periods of the market cycles, whether it's, you know, during COVID or during right now, they've stayed pretty strong. And I also recall, you know, what the Brookfield CEO, Bruce Flatt, used to talk about a lot, right? Is the fact that, again, during these difficult times, you know, the poor quality retail in smaller cities with not a lot of people, those are the stores or the spaces that tend not to do very well. However, the very high quality established retail in large cities are actually the ones that will keep getting bigger. And we're seeing this happen with Ryokan's properties. Another key indicator of their success is the household income of the people around their properties. So they do the study, which is really cool. Within 5 kilometer radius of their properties, the average household income is $140,000. Now, my friends, that compares to, you know, Canadian averages of just under 100,000, just to give you an idea, right? So the average people around the Ryokan properties make 40% more than the average in the country. That's a huge deal because when consumers are in trouble, right, they spend less. But if you're already rich, you probably spend less, but not to the point that the whole, you know, business environment around you is totally going to fall apart. So that's very important. Some more number crunching for you. The average net rent per square foot has gone up every single year since 2019. Their blended leasing spreads have gone up since 2020 and are now higher than in 2019. And their retention ratios have stayed pretty much flat since 2019 as well. So in terms of the now, in terms of the regular base business of Ryokan, they're clearly doing well. They're operating from a place of strength. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. But what's exciting about them is the future. What they've decided is, we are too exposed to retail, even though we dominate in retail and we're very good. We need to try other stuff. And so they decided to go into the residential space. It is still very small for them. Their units actually right now represent about 4% of their rent. So really, it's not that much. But they are growing. So they've added 694 units in 2019, 524 in 2020, 480 in 2021, 521 in 2022, 716 in 2023. So now, total, they've got 2,935 units in 13 buildings, and that number is growing every year. So it's nice to see that they're able to be nimble. They have their base business that's doing very well, but they're able to try other things, again, depending on where the market's going right now. And of course, we know that there's a shortage of housing. We know that housing, as a result, is a pretty attractive venture for a lot of these real estate businesses. So it's nice that they're able to do that. Their capital allocation framework also is very nice, very disciplined. What they did a few years ago, I mean, this was a very criticized decision, and I myself was a big hater, was their cut of the distribution. So they were actually going to reach that cut their dividend, but this now enables them to have a very low payout ratio and to be able to start all these projects taking on minimal debt because they can afford it just with their funds from operations that they're generating, plus a bit of capital recycling, and then again, a very minimal amount of debt. So, you know, cutting your dividend, it's not great, but it can yield some good results for the future, and I think they're making use of the cut in an attractive way that makes me as a shareholder actually pretty happy. So yeah, overall, looking at Ryokan's price, obviously pretty bad, but that's why we call it a contrarian stock. I think the market doesn't like it, but it's probably going to come back. You know, it's not a business that I'm concerned about in the least right now. And like I said, I'm happy to hold. I own it at an average cost basis around $14. And, you know, I'm keeping it right there. I love Ryokan. Our last contrarian stock of the episode. I'm not going to go on about this one for too long because I've done so many episodes about it, but my friends, Brookfield Renewable, this business once again has fallen under the $30 mark. I've actually added to it. Now, if you're listening to this episode and you are a fellow shareholder, you know, perhaps you're face-palming, perhaps you're shaking your head in disdain and despair, is what I said. You know, and I don't blame you, because it has not been pleasant to be a shareholder of Brookfield Renewable in the last 4 years, which is a long time, right? It hit a crazy high in December 2020, I believe, and it's been on a downward spiral since then. And yet, I think it is a good investment right now. I'm not saying anything new, I'm reiterating what I said in a past episode, but if we forgot about the price for a sec, if there was just no price, if you didn't see what the price was, and you just looked at the business and you followed their actual progress as a company in the last 4 years, clearly it is a much bigger, better, stronger, more exciting business now than it used to be, right? The problem was, of course, those 4 years ago, it was severely mispriced. We were in this hype period where everything in 2020 was, you know, trading at ridiculous prices and people were buying, and it was a mistake to buy at the time, right? But now, I really don't think it is. You lock in a really strong dividend. I mean, we're talking 6%+, I believe, right? And now, of course, you should not invest based on the yield, and I'm certainly not saying that's what to do. But I am saying, if you take that as, you know, one of your key indicators, if you trade at such a high dividend yield, it's probably a sign that your dividend's about to be cut. And yet, if you analyze the business, it doesn't seem like it's going to be cut. In fact, they've just increased it, and I believe they're going to continue doing that, right? Now, if they'd manage to continue that, do we really think a business like this is going to trade at a 6%+ dividend forever? I think it will not. And then if we look again at the numbers, you know, their track record, since 2016, we've got a 12% per unit FFO compound annual growth rate and a 6% distributions per unit compound annual growth rate. The fact that they are so diversified across renewable technologies, they're probably the most diversified by country and by technology of all the Canadian companies in renewables, right? That means that their earnings are less volatile as well, which is a huge asset for a business owner who doesn't like volatility, right? Which I personally don't. The fact that their biggest segment is hydro. Hydro tends to be the least volatile of the renewable sources of energy too. That's also a big help. So I really think here this is a true contrarian play, where you have a high quality business that is growing fast, that is, you know, paying a very generous dividend that it can afford. It's like everything is aligned for us to say, oh my God, this is a great opportunity. So the same way I was buying lots of Brookfield Corporation last year when it was trading in the, you know, low 40s, and now I do feel somewhat vindicated because it's up quite a bit since then, I'm looking at it the same now for Brookfield Renewable specifically. I think this is a business and a sector overall that is being mispriced to the downside. A lot of investors don't like it, but I think, you know, this is the right area to be in the next decade or so. And if we assume that interest rates slowly at some point will start decreasing, I think these types of businesses are the first that will really benefit from that. So, like I said, I highly recommend you check out, I did a whole episode, it was, what was it called? Brookfield Soldiers or something like that, where we analyzed Brookfield Renewable, Brookfield Infrastructure, and Brookfield Business Partners. So I'd recommend checking that episode out for, you know, more detail on Brookfield Renewable. But I would just reiterate this as a contrarian stock, again, that I personally bought with my money and that I think is going to do well. And this is one I've owned for years and I will continue to own for years. Anyhow, my friends, thank you as always for listening to the New Crime Investor channel. If you like this episode, make sure to give us a 5-star, make sure to share with a friend, and I look forward to connecting again with you soon.